So today, final set of lectures today. So we're going to keep talking about stationary black holes in the context where the black hole might be surrounded by a distribution of matter. We've seen the conditions that the requirement that the spacetime be stationary give us. So we have to have an axisymmetric distribution of matter. Of course, the matter itself has to be stationary. And the reason for this is that if we didn't have that, then there would be a torque interaction between the black hole and the matter, and in the course of time, things would relax to an axisymmetric situation, or the black hole would be driven down to a static configuration, which is a special case of everything that we're talking about anyway. So the black hole is stationary, and it automatically is axisymmetric. We have this combination of the two fundamental killing vectors being null on the horizon, so that makes the horizon a killing horizon. And the stationary condition tells us that, well, the rate of change of anything along the generators of the event horizon is going to be vanishing. And as we worked out the consequences, well, it means that the expansion of the null geodesics has to vanish, the shear tensor of the null geodesics has to vanish. And if we incorporate all of this information into Ray Chowdhury's equation, everything on the right-hand side vanishing guarantees that this component of the Ricci tensor vanishes. And if we re-express this in terms of the stress tensor by using the Einstein field equations, we have that this component of the energy momentum tensor of the matter has to vanish. That doesn't mean that the stress tensor itself has to, must vanish. There can be matter, threading the event horizon. And an example of this would be a magnetic field. You can have a black hole immersed in a magnetic field, and the magnetic field has a stress tensor that can, go from the outside to the inside of the event horizon. But this particular component of that stress tensor is guaranteed to vanish if the black hole is to be stationary. All right, so we talked about various things like this. I have the Gauss-Gedassi equations that I've already used in the form of Ray Chowdhury's equation, and now we're going to be exploring the consequence of this and use it in a proof of the zeroth law. And then there's a couple of extra facts that probably will come up during today's lecture. And the timing is good for the zeroth law because, in the homework assignment, you had to give me a proof based on, similar but not quite the same, the same set of ideas. And here I'm going to give you a proof based on that Gauss-Gedassi equation, which I think is very attractive because very direct. But of course, it's very direct only after you've derived this, which we didn't do in the course. But at least I think I gave you the essential ideas behind where this is coming from when we were talking about null hypersurfaces. But once we have that, and once we have the stationary condition, well, then it's almost, it's almost done. And that's what we're going to do today. So the hard part is to convince ourselves that the left-hand side of that equation is zero. And that's something that was also part of the homework assignment, so we can, so we can deal with this, pretty quickly. Okay, so we're going to be talking about the zeroth law of black hole mechanics. And that's the statement that the surface gravity, which in our, context here is defined to be that parameter that appears in the geodesic equation for the null generators of the event horizon, that kappa here on the right-hand side, when this equation is applied specifically to the generators of a stationary horizon, we find that kappa must be constant on the horizon. And at first that might be a surprising statement, because if you think of the surface gravity of the Earth, incorporate the rotation of the Earth, well, because the equator of the Earth is a little bit larger than the polar radius, so the surface gravity of the Earth at the equator is a bit weaker than at the poles. It's the equator is farther away from the center compared with the poles. So if you actually measure the surface gravity of the Earth, you do find a variation on the surface of the Earth. But if we do this for a rotating black hole, in spite of the bulging geometry of the equator of the event horizon, we do have that statement that the surface gravity is perfectly constant. So there's something very peculiar, but also very nice about the structure of black holes that give us this result here. Now, in our language here, that means two things. It means, first of all, that the surface gravity doesn't change as we move up along the generators. And of course, that's not surprising. That comes for free from the stationarity condition. The rate of change with respect to the V parameter on the null geodesics must be zero. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a stationary situation. But what we also have to prove is that as we move from generator to generator, we don't see a change in the kappa parameter. And that's the hard part to prove, as you can probably bear witness now, having worked through that homework problem. And that's why I wanted to approach it a little bit differently based on those Gauss-Kedassi equations, because, as I said, the proof there is very direct. All right, so let's consider that to be obvious, and that's the thing that we have to verify. And I'm going to go back to that equation, and then I'm going to stare at that equation, and we're going to see that a lot of stuff is zero in that equation. So the V derivative of whatever omega happens to be, well, that's got to be zero, because nothing depends on V on a stationary horizon. This is the thing that we want to prove is zero. But other than that, well, theta is zero, the shear tensor is zero, and theta is zero, which means that this will be zero if we can convince ourselves that the left-hand side is zero. And that's something that is not necessarily a given, and that's something that will require the imposition of an energy condition. And I think it's the dominant energy condition. So the Gauss-Kedassi equation tells us that derivative of the surface gravity is equal to that component of the Ricci tensor. And if we're using the Einstein field equations, that's going to be equal to this component of the stress tensor. So when I'm using the Einstein field equations, I'm relating the Ricci tensor to the stress tensor and its trace. But the trace term involves the metric. And because those vectors are orthogonal, that term disappears. So we have a direct equality here between this component of the Ricci tensor and this component of the stress tensor. And then I'm just going to come up with some convenient notation. I'm going to say that J alpha is going to be, by definition, it's going to be this component of the stress tensor, this projection of the stress tensor, with a minus sign, and then all of this boils down to the statement that the A derivative of kappa is going to be equal to 8 pi J alpha projected onto the transverse directions associated with the congruence. So the whole point is that we want to prove that this is zero, and that requires, a little bit of a examination of what J is, what it means physically, and trying to understand why it has to be zero, that component, these projections of the J vector have to be zero on a stationary horizon. So that's where we're going to spend a little bit of time doing, but it's basically just duplicating the last part of the proof that you gave me in the homework assignment. Okay, so we're good so far? Okay. So what's the interpretation of this? So I think it's useful to think about what it might mean physically first, And then we can sort of come to an understanding about what it means to make this zero and why it, you know, why it should be. And what I like to do in cases like this is to make up a model for the matter. And then we can look into, you know, what this means for that particular model. And here we have a choice. We could look at an electromagnetic field. We could look at a scalar field. We could look at all sorts of things. I'm just going to do the simplest thing possible and to look at pressureless fluid. So we're going to make a little model that's going to be very simple. And our model is such that we're going to be dealing with a perfect fluid with no pressure. And that's about as simple a model that you can make for matter. And I think it, you know, it's enough to illustrate what, you know, what this thing actually is. Okay, so that's pressureless matter, pressureless fluid, which is also called dust in our part of physics. Okay, so let's work out a few consequences of this model first, and then we'll put things together. So we have a stress tensor that's going to be conserved, as all stress tensors must be. And if we work out the consequences of this, well, we can just take the derivative of the right-hand side. And I'm going to split this up into two separate terms. So first, I'm going to lump the rho and the u beta together. And I'm going to write the first term as the divergence of rho u beta. And that will multiply u alpha, who's not differentiated yet. And then I'm going to differentiate u alpha, and I'm going to get rho u beta, and then the beta derivative of u alpha. And this thing here is what we recognize as the acceleration associated with the velocity field that the matter is giving us. So the whole thing must be zero, but what we have here are two orthogonal vectors. U is orthogonal to A, and if you have the sum of two orthogonal vectors being zero, that means that each vector individually must be zero. So we can say that this must be zero all by itself. And the interpretation of this equation here is that of conservation of mass, rho standing for the mass density, of course. And we also have the statement that the acceleration of our, you know, fluid is zero, which means that the, you know, the fluid elements are moving on geodesics. The fact that we don't have pressure in the system means that all the dust particles are moving independently of one with respect to each other, and they all move on the geodesics of the spacetime. All right, so the conservation equations give us, and the fact that we have a stationary spacetime and an axisymmetric spacetime, and the fact that we have geodesic motion means that for each fluid element, we have a couple of conserved quantities. We have conserved quantities along the motions. And the first one is energy per unit mass, and that's just the projection of the velocity vector on the time-like killing vector. So that's energy per unit mass. And we also have angular momentum per unit mass, which is the projection of the velocity with the axisymmetric killing vector, and that's angular momentum. Per unit mass. And both of those things here are conserved quantities. They're constants of the motion because the motion is geodesic. All right. So, very simple matter model, and then we can, you know, really identify everything that's going on, and that's always nice to be able to rely on that. So if I'm looking at the J vector and incorporate the minus sign, what we have is rho that multiplies u multiplies, multiplies k. And and then leaves me with a U alpha. So I'll write it as positive rho, and then I have minus U times K, and that multiplies U alpha. And I think now we can see, you know, an interpretation coming out of this. So here we have minus U multiplying K. And if we work in a frame where U is aligned with the time direction, U with the index down will have a negative time entry. K will have a positive time entry. So that product here with the minus sign is actually positive, and it just denotes some kind of, you know, boost factor. And if we work it out in full, well, it's going to be E minus omega H times J. So when we multiply the mass density times something like this, well, we convert this into an energy density. We convert this because that's energy per unit mass. When we measure, when we multiply by mass density, we get energy density minus omega H times angular momentum density. So basically, all of this gives me some kind of, you know, energy density, you know, modified by angular momentum. All of that is crossing the, you know, is moving in space-time. With, you know, that quantity over here, that density of sort of modified energy is moving with a velocity vector U alpha. So all I'm trying to say here, and I think I'm making it sound more complicated than it is, what we're dealing here with is some kind of energy flux vector. So we have something that is multiplied by U that makes it a flux. So if you look at the spatial components of this, we have a quantity being carried forward by the fluid velocity. And what is being carried forward by the fluid velocity is basically that modified energy density. And that's the meaning of J. All right. So when we talk about that quantity here, and that's not restricted to that, you know, very simple model, very specific model, what we're talking about here is some kind of, you know, energy flux vector. All right. Okay. So, well, hopefully the interpretation effort here was useful, but regardless, we can proceed. Regardless of that, what we want to prove is that this component of that J vector vanishes, but it's not going to vanish regardless of, you know, energy conditions. So what we're going to have to impose here is the dominant energy condition. So that's going to be a condition on the zeroth law. So we have the dominant energy condition. And that's the statement that any energy flux vector that you can define in space-time, that must be, you know, that flux must be flowing either along time-like curves or null curves. So that vector must be time-like or null. You will never get energy flowing across space-like directions. So that's the meaning of the dominant energy condition. The vector must be time-like or null, and of course, it's understood that it's going to be future-directed. So, stuff traveling in the space-time, you know, energy traveling in space-time will be traveling toward the future, either along a time-like or a null vector. And that, well, will be you know, constraining things sufficiently, and the stationary condition that we worked out before, that will be constraining things even more. And when we're done putting all of those ingredients together, we're going to find that, sure enough, the projection of J along the spatial vectors on the event horizon, that has to vanish. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so let's work out the consequences of all this. And, you know, in calculations like this, it's good to go back to our old ideas of introducing a decomposition of a vector. And here we're going to do it with the basis that's given to us on the event horizon. So we have k going along the generators, we have the e vectors being transverse to the generators, and then we complete the basis with that n vector. And what we're going to do is to look at this decomposition and start incorporating all of those constraints. And the first constraint I'll impose is the one coming from stationarity, and that's the statement that J alpha projected along K must vanish. And if we work this out through the decomposition, K and K, you know, vanish, K multiplying K vanishes anyway, so that doesn't contribute. K and N give us a minus one, so that scalar product gives us a contribution from this term minus B, and then K is orthogonal to this, so that doesn't contribute. And this restriction here tells us that B must be zero, and that means that, well, the decomposition actually simplifies and we kill the N term. So that's one thing. The other thing is that now I have to impose the condition that J alpha must be time-like or null. And what this translates to is the statement that the scalar product must be non-positive. And we can insert what remains of the decomposition into that statement and see what we learn from that. So if we do that, then we're going to get, well, I just plug it in, AK plus CAE A alpha, multiplying the same thing all over again. Have to make sure to not be confused with the repeated indices here. I can't repeat the repeated indices. So that product must be non-negative. So let's work out the product on the left-hand side. K times K is zero. K times E is zero. E times K is zero. So the only thing that survives here is CACB, and then we get the scalar product between two E vectors, and that defines the transverse metric on the event horizon. And that's the statement that this product here must be non-negative, must be non-positive. But that product, if it exists, you know, that's the product of a positive definite two-dimensional metric with a vector. So that's the scalar product of a two-dimensional vector with a positive metric. That cannot be negative. So we have, you know, the right-hand side that cannot be negative, the right-hand side that cannot be positive. The only possible resolution is for CA to be zero. So that's what the combination of the null energy, the dominant energy condition, and the condition of stationarity gives us. And the only thing that survives then in the decomposition of J is that J must must be a null vector that in fact aligns with the generators of the event horizon. So J must be aligned with the K vector that's tangent to those null generators. And now we're done. The right-hand side here is the product of J with E. K is orthogonal to E, so that product is zero. And we automatically get from this, you know, with all the imposed condition, that kappa cannot change as we go from one generator to another generator. All the kappas must be all the same. And that is the statement of the zeroth law. And what we see is that the zeroth law is established, but at the cost of imposing the dominant energy condition. And of course, in the course of all of this, we converted a statement on the Ricci tensor into a statement on the stress tensor, as is normally done. But that's a step that involves the Einstein field equations. So if you wanted to repeat this discussion to some other theory of gravity, Well, you probably would have to, you know, justify the condition on the Ricci tensor using probably different, you know, a different strategy, something that would look a little bit different. But in the end, basically, we're just restricting one particular component of the Ricci Ricci curvature. And if we, you know, if we have that, which we do, when we have, you know, in this context, we do. Then we have a very neat statement about the nature of the surface gravity of an event horizon when the horizon is stationary. So that's the zeroth law. And it's called that, of course, because it's very similar to the zeroth law of thermodynamics that states that the temperature of a thermodynamic system when it's in equilibrium is also constant. So, you know, there's a lot of those analogies that were very sort of, you know, gripping the attention of researchers back in the early 70s. Okay, any questions about this?
We didn't derive the second point, right? But like, I got out for Gauss second point in terms of the extrinsic curvature, right? But then I would just write it as a, how do we write it in terms of the shear? I just use the definition that there's a gradient, not gradient, but grad alpha n beta, where n is the normal.
Right.
Yeah.
So So in the case of, you know, so basically you just reproduce for null surfaces what we did for time-like or space-like surfaces. Instead of dealing with the extrinsic curvature, we're dealing with a collection of quantities like omega and b and things like that. But you just basically go through all of this, you know, but in the null context, and then it just pops out in the same way. Another way of doing it is, when we were doing null hypersurfaces, I wrote down a metric that describes space-time in a neighborhood of a null hypersurface, and you just use that metric to calculate the Ricci tensor, and then relate it to all the quantities that were defined, and that's another way of doing it, and that's analogous to the, you know, doing it with Gaussian coordinates when we were doing it for time-like and space-like surfaces. Right, so I didn't go through those details here, but I think, you know, in spirit and in terms of what we've seen before, I think, you know, it's something that just follows in a similar way. So I didn't see the need to go through those details. All right, other questions about this? All right. So that's the zeroth law. Soon we're going to be talking about a first law, and we'll be talking about a second law. I won't be talking about the third law. But before we get to the first law, which was this differential relation between mass and area and angular momentum, before I get to that, I want to go back to the idea that we can have an algebraic relation between the black hole mass and the area and the angular momentum, something we were able to derived specifically for a Kerr black hole before, and now I claim can be done regardless of the exact specification of the space-time when we have, you know, potentially the presence of matter around the black hole. So I'm going to provide a derivation of that generalized version of that mass relation that we talked about before. All right, so where do I want to go? Okay, so let's talk about the mass law. And before I go through the entire derivation, which will take a little bit of an effort, let me tell you what it is. I'll just write it down and then we'll derive it. So we imagine a situation like this where we have a black hole potentially surrounded by matter around it. We have a stationary space-time. And because it's stationary, it's also axisymmetric. And what I'm going to derive here is a relationship between the total mass of the space-time, and that includes a contribution from the black hole and a contribution from the matter around it. And that total mass for the spacetime, I can relate to properties of the black hole like surface gravity area, angular velocity, and angular momentum. But I can also relate it to how much matter there is, and that's going to be expressed as a hypersurface integral. Namely, I'm taking the matter at one instant of time, and I measure the matter content of the total mass through the stress tensor. And the exact expression of this is that we have the stress tensor, and there's going to be a trace term, and that will be multiplying the time-like killing vector, and we will be integrating over the hypersurface, which means that we have the hypersurface measure d sigma alpha that shows up in the integral. So that's the mass formula, and before we get into the derivation, I just want to make sure that we understand what it means. So that's the total mass as would be measured at infinity. So it really incorporates everything. And then over here, we have the area of the black hole. So that's pretty clear. I'm going to have to come up with some definition for the angular momentum of the black hole. We'll come to that. And then we have a contribution from the hypersurface here. And, let's see. So I'm going to describe it like this. So we have the horizon that I will, depict as a null surface like this, moving at 45 degrees. And then we have a hypersurface, sigma, that is basically a moment in time. And it's basically, well, let me put it this way. So it's the surface to which the time-like killing vector would be everywhere orthogonal. So I'm using the stationary properties here in a very essential way because, the time-like killing vector here shows up. It shows up in, all of those quantities that I'm defining on the right-hand side. And it also, gives me the property that the space-like hypersurface that we're talking about here is one for which, the time-like killing vector is actually orthogonal. And now I'm wondering whether I mean that or not. Because my time-like killing vector is not necessarily hypersurface orthogonal. So yeah, I didn't mean that. So I'll just say that this is a stationary surface. Okay. So that's the meaning of all of this. So basically, we say that the mass at infinity can be broken up into stuff coming from the black hole. So all of this here would basically be the mass of the black hole related to its area and angular momentum. And then everything else is whatever the matter outside is contributing. And all of this can be stated without knowing the explicit form of the metric. So it's pretty remarkable that this can be arrived at. Without an explicit knowledge of, the metric that describes the spacetime. And, this whole discussion that we're going through here is basically in that, spirit where we want to describe everything that's going on in the spacetime without even knowing what the actual metric is. So if we did know the metric and didn't know the specification of the stress tensor, we could calculate this integral. We're not doing that. But other than that, everything is very general. Okay, so I want to provide a derivation of this, and it's not that difficult, it's just that we have to go through all the steps. And the first thing we have to ask is, well, what's that notion of total mass at infinity? And there are lots of notions of total mass at infinity, depending on the context. Here we're talking specifically about a stationary spacetime. We could be asking the same question about a spacetime that is radiating or has some time-dependent processes going through it. So we're not asking that general question. We're asking what's the mass at infinity that an observer would measure in one of those stationary spacetimes. And I'll give two answers to this. one that would be very much tied to the coordinate system, and another one that's very much tied with all of the geometric properties of the spacetime, namely the existence of a time-like Killing vector. And then I'll show you that those two answers are exactly the same. All right, so what is total mass? That's the question. And the coordinate answer is to say that, well, okay, so suppose that my distribution of matter is actually bounded, so it doesn't go all the way to infinity, but it sort of stops somewhere. Then if I'm outside of this, the spacetime outside of that will look, to a good approximation, if I'm really far away, like a Schwarzschild solution. And in the coordinate system that I would adopt, you know, a time coordinate that would be attached to the, you know, to the time-like Killing vector, for that spacetime, the asymptotic form of the metric would be minus 1 plus 2m over r plus potentially terms that drop off faster in powers of r. So I'm not saying that it's precisely equal to Schwarzschild. I'm saying that to a good approximation and to leading order in 1 over r, well, including the minus 1, we get something that agrees with the Schwarzschild metric, and we can read off the mass from that particular component of the metric using r and using t as coordinates. So that would be a perfectly fine answer. But it's an answer that's very much tied to a particular choice of coordinate system. And, you know, in GR, sometimes we like to do better than this and to provide an answer that's more geometrical. So let's look at the geometrical answer. And here I'm going to think of defining total mass of a spacetime, at least in this context of a stationary spacetime, in the way that I could define total charge if I were to deal with electromagnetism. And the way that we like to do it in ENM is to say, well, let's enclose our space with a sphere. You know, it doesn't have to be an exact sphere, but something that topologically look like a sphere. And then let's measure the normal component to the electric field on that sphere. Let's integrate over the whole sphere. And then by Gauss's law, we get the total charge out of that, total enclosed charge. So can we do something similar here? Can we come up with some kind of thing, you know, some kind of geometrical structure that we can integrate on a sphere at infinity, and that would give us the mass in the end? So the proposal is that, well, I want to calculate the mass or define the mass of a stationary spacetime, assuming, of course, that everything goes nicely to a flat structure at infinity, as a surface integral at infinity. And if I'm doing this, then I know that I'm integrating over a two-dimensional surface. I know that that two-dimensional surface will have two normals, one space-like, one time-like. And I know that the surface element is going to be an anti-symmetric thing, where, you know, given by something that we worked out before, involving the two normals of my two-dimensional surface. So we're looking for something like this, and then we're looking at something over here that also probably should be an anti-symmetric tensor, because anything that's not anti-symmetric, you know, we'll lose everything. So if we have a tensor here that's not already anti-symmetric, contraction with the measure here will kill all of the components that are not anti-symmetric. So, you know, we might as well restrict whatever we put in here to an anti-symmetric tensor, because it's going to be multiplying that other anti-symmetric tensor. And then, you know, we start hunting for what is there at our disposal to do this. And we're, you know, because we're dealing with a stationary spacetime, we know that the Killing vector is there for us to play with. And we know by Killing's equation that the gradient of the Killing tensor is an antisymmetric tensor. So it looks perfectly natural to expect that what we need to put in here would be something like this, which is an available antisymmetric tensor. And then the only other thing that we need to do, presumably, is to make sure that the numerical coefficient is chosen appropriately. And I'm just going to claim here that it's going to be minus 1 over 8 pi. So in the spirit of Gauss's law, we have a surface integral definition of total mass involving, you know, the integration measure on that two-dimensional surface in terms of the two normals, and in, you know, and then involving the you know, a preferred or, you know, a natural, you know, arising antisymmetric tensor coming from the Killing vector and the Killing equation guaranteeing that that is actually an antisymmetric tensor. And then it's just a matter of, you know, trying this out and verifying that this actually does make sense and agrees with the more primitive or the more, you know, coordinate-based definition. And then it's just a matter of doing a quick calculation, and we can do it in 2 seconds, and we'll verify that this agrees with that so that we have a nice geometrical definition for total mass that captures everything that total mass, you know, should give us. So that's the idea. We can do it also for angular momentum, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But let's just do a quick calculation now. So I'm going to write the integrand here. I'm going to write it as, I think I'm going to write it like this. I'm going to lower some of the indices. I'm going to incorporate that definition for the integration for the surface element. And because this is already antisymmetric, the operation of antisymmetrization here becomes redundant, so we don't have to carry this forward. So what do I have? What I have over here is 2 that multiplies R alpha, that multiplies N beta, and beyond that we have the scalar surface element, and, well, we'll work this out in just a second. So what do I have to calculate? I have to calculate minus 1 over 4 pi, the covariant derivative of the time-like Killing vector, multiplying R alpha, multiplying N beta, and then multiplying, well, the surface element at infinity, which, if I'm using coordinates, you know, I'm using this coordinate system over here, that's going to be R squared d omega. D omega is d. Element of solid angle. Okay, well, after that, it gets pretty easy. The so the covariant derivative involves a partial derivative, but my in the coordinate system, my time-like Killing vector just has a constant entry along time, so that doesn't give us anything. So what do we have is purely coming from a Christoffel symbol, and that will be multiplying R alpha and beta. And then if we work this out, and of course we're doing the calculation in infinity, the time-like Killing vector has only a time component. The radial normal vector is going to have an R component, and the normal vector is going to be aligned with the time-like Killing vector that only has, you know, a time component as well. So I have to account for a change in sign when I lower the index. So what we have here is gamma t, t, r. And all we have to do is to calculate this Christoffel symbol, and we have our answer. And after that, we multiply by r squared and d omega. So what is this? Well, let's complete the calculation. We get minus 1/2. Then for this, we have, you know, we multiply by gtt with the indices upstairs, and to leading order, that's minus 1. And then what else do we get? We get the t derivative of gtr. Then we get the r derivative of gtt. And then we get minus the t derivative of gtr. Those are all the metric derivatives that are required here. We have a cancellation, but regardless, this would be 0 because the space-time is stationary and we don't have time derivatives. And then all we have to do is to calculate that time, that radial derivative of GTT. So we get 1/2. And then that multiplies the R derivative of GTT, which is minus 2m over R squared. So with all of this, we get minus m over R squared. We had an overall minus sign over here. We have a factor of R squared that comes from area element. And what do we get? 1 over 4 pi multiplies m multiplies d omega. And sure enough, after we integrate over the sphere, we get rid of the 4 pi, and we get m coming out. So a very natural looking, very plausible definition for total mass turns out to work precisely and reproduces the coordinate definition. So that will be for, you know, our discussion here, the starting definition for total mass. All right? Okay. So that's going to be the starting point of the derivation. We could do something similar for angular momentum. So let me just mention this quickly. So what is total angular momentum? J. Well, again, two possible answers. One coming from the coordinates. So in a coordinate system where the space-time is stationary and axisymmetric, we have a well-defined G T phi component to the metric. And then asymptotically, this would be given by the same expression we got for the Kerr solution. It would be minus 2J over R multiplying sine squared theta. Sine squared theta. And then because it's not precisely Kerr necessarily, we would get subdominant terms in the expansion of the metric at large, you know, distances. So that would be, you know, a coordinate definition, and we would identify this coefficient here as a proper definition of angular momentum for stationary and axisymmetric spacetime. But of course, we want to do better. And because this strategy works so well for mass, maybe we can adapt it to angular momentum. And the obvious thing to do will be to replace the t-killing vector by the phi-killing vector. So the other answer that we could proceed with is, you know, a similar idea. We have a two-dimensional surface at infinity. And instead of using the time-like killing vector, we use the axisymmetric killing vector as the stuff that we integrate against the usual integration measure on the two surface. And then the only thing that we have to adjust here is the numerical coefficient. And instead of minus 1 over 8 pi, it's now plus 1 over 4 pi. No big deal. It's not too surprising that we would have to, you know, sorry, it's 16 pi. And that's, you know, a very plausible, you know, very nice looking expression for total angular momentum. And then if you just do simple calculations like I did using this form for the metric, you will find that this definition agrees with that definition. So everything, you know, everything is consistent and looks pretty good. Okay. So now we have a starting point for our calculation. And the idea would be to start at infinity, where we can, you know, define total mass, and try to go into the space-time all the way down to the black hole, so that as we do this, we can see how much matter we encounter and assign a numerical value for the mass for that matter that we encounter along the way. So the idea is to go from infinity and then find a way to go deep in until we reach the black hole and try to break down this total mass into a matter contribution and black hole stuff like we had displayed. And the tool to do that is going to be to use Stokes' theorem. So something that we talked about fairly briefly, but we didn't mention it before. So let's remember what that was. So the statement of Stokes' theorem is that we have some kind of hypersurface. I'll take it here to be space-like, but it doesn't have to be. And it's going to be bounded by a two-dimensional surface. So that would be the side view of it. That would be our sigma. And that would be part of the boundary. And then if I show you a top view, then that would be our sigma, and that would be the boundary delta sigma. So that's 3D, that's 2D. And of course, in the drawing, I've lost one dimension. And the statement of the theorem is that a boundary integral of an antisymmetric tensor can be related to the, so that would be a closed boundary integral, can be related to the divergence of that antisymmetric tensor integrated over the three-dimensional surface. So that's the statement of Stokes' theorem, and except for the fact that there's a factor of two there. Right. So, just to specify it, so this is an antisymmetric tensor. And that's a mathematical identity, which I didn't prove, but you can find a proof in the book in the relevant section of it. Okay, so the idea is we want to use this, and that's how that hypersurface integral will emerge through this identity over here. And the only thing we have to account for is the fact that our boundary, well, there's actually two pieces to it. There's going to be the boundary part at infinity, and there's going to be the boundary at the horizon. So the actual situations we want to consider is not quite this one, but it's a situation where we have the boundary at infinity joined or together with a boundary at the black hole, namely a cross-section of the event horizon. So it's a two-boundary thing. And you remember what we always do in the situation like this. In order to turn two boundaries into a single boundary, we just dig a little channel here. And by digging that channel, we basically join the two boundaries together into a common joined boundary. So that's going to be our sigma. And the union of the black hole, I'll call it the horizon. The union of the horizon and infinity is going to be our common boundary delta sigma. And there's a reason why I'm saying that this is infinity minus h, and that's the only source of aggravation in this entire calculation, and that has to do with the fact that what is outward is not outward everywhere. So I'll tell you all about this now. Okay. All right, so we're going to apply Stokes' theorem to this construction over here, and that's how we'll be able to basically break down a surface integral at infinity into a surface integral on the horizon, and the rest of it that will be coming from the hypersurface. So that's how it's going to go. And the trick to achieve this was to dig that little channel over here. But when we apply Stokes' theorem, we have to remember that all the normals that are defined here are supposed to be outward normals, out of the common boundary. And that's always a little confusing. So here's what I'm talking about. So d sigma, ds alpha beta is the union of the two normals to the, to the two-dimensional surface. And n we won't have to worry about. N is always going to be a future-directed normal vector. So that will always point in a consistent direction. But here it's very important that when we use Stokes' theorem, that R alpha be defined as the outward normal to the common boundary. And what this means is that if we're at infinity, R will be pointing out, as it must. But if we're on the black hole, it must be pointing out of the boundary, out of the surface, which means into the black hole. In the little channel over here, it's going to be pointing out on one side of it, and it's going to be pointing out on the other side of it. But here we see that the two directions are opposite, and that tells us that the contribution from the channel will vanish in the end, in the limit where the channel is very thin. The fact that we have opposite directions for the outward normal tells us that that contribution will vanish. So that's why we never have to worry about the explicit, you know, contribution from the channel. So the only thing that I want to change here in, you know, how I choose to apply Stokes' theorem is that when I'm done with all of this, I want to turn this around, and instead of having a radial vector that points into the black hole, I want to have a radial vector that points out of the black hole. So what we're going to do is to change the convention so that the R that shows up in the integration measure when it's applied to the horizon will be turned around. And that means that there's going to be an overall sign difference between the two. And that means that there's going to be a negative sign contribution from the, you know, horizon contribution of the common boundary. Right? So we do that all the time when we do Stokes' theorem. And we'll do more of that when, you know, when we're going to be applying the Gauss's theorem in, you know, in a later discussion. And the minus sign is very confusing, but if you think about it, it's just that if it's outward of the boundary, it's not outward of the horizon. And what I want to do is to settle on a convention where all of my normal vectors are outward of the given surface. So that means we're going to change it around like that, by hand. Okay, so I hope that was clear. So what are we going to do? Well, let me apply the Stokes' theorem. I'll leave B alpha beta arbitrary for now, and I'll just say that my, you know, contribution from the boundary is now going to be broken up into an infinity piece and a horizon piece. And if I were dealing consistently with an outward radial vector everywhere, the horizon piece would come with a positive sign. But because I flipped that sign, now it comes with a negative sign. So the definition of this is not the same as the direction of that, because I flipped the direction of the radial normal vector. So that's why we have a minus sign here, and that's the only source of subtlety in this whole calculation. Okay, and now that we have that, well, we can write down the fuller expression of the Stokes' theorem. We can say that the integral at infinity, now defined as a closed integral for any b alpha beta, is going to be an integral on the horizon. And then by Gauss's, by Stokes' theorem, we have the contribution from the hypersurface in between. And that involves the divergence of B integrated over the hypersurface. So that's the sort of refined version of Stokes' theorem, where we have an outside boundary and an inside boundary. And we can write it like this instead of the original form where we had to make sure that there was only one boundary. Okay, is that clear to everybody? After that, it's all pretty smooth sailing. Okay, so let's see, how do I want to do this? Okay, so let's apply this to two versions of B. So the first version of B is going to be arm 1 over 8 pi gradient of the time-like killing vector. And if we apply it to that, then that's going to be our total mass. What we're going to have over here is going to be, well, what we would call the mass of the black hole, the boundary integral on the black hole. And then we would have a contribution for the matter. And that would be given by the divergence of the gradient of T. So that's going to be, that's going to be where I want to be. Sorry, that's where I want to. So that's how I'm going to get started with, getting closer to that first law over there. Sorry, that mass relation over there. And I'm going to have to work on various things, including that and including this also. I could write a similar identity between J and the black hole contribution and the matter contribution. It would look almost identical to this, except that the identity of the killing vector would be changed. But I won't need that, but I will need an expression for the black hole contribution to angular momentum, because as you see, it enters the mass relation directly. So I'll just say that, well, the black hole mass, what do we mean by this? We just mean that we have 1 over 8 pi, the surface integral of the horizon, and we integrate this on the horizon. And then for the black hole angular momentum, we have plus 1 over 16 pi, an integral on the horizon of the gradient of the phi killing vector. And that's what enters the expression of the mass law over there. Okay, so I'm going to be working on all of this. That gives me the definition I wanted. We will be working on that one, and we will be working on the hypersurface integral to turn that into something that involves the stress tensor of the matter. So we still have to do a lot of work, some work, but it's not going to be that bad. And we're going to recycle stuff that we've done before. So we're still good? All right. So let's work on the black hole mass. So as you notice, what I've done over there is to relate the black hole mass to area and angular momentum. So we're going to try and do that here. So I'm going to start with, seemingly a strange combination of things. And what I want here, is this combination of omega h minus 2 omega h jh. So I just want to look at this and do a little calculation for that. And we're going to see that, we're going to get this in terms of the area of the black hole in just a few lines of calculation. And that will allow me to replace the black hole mass by something that, looks like this. So we're going to look into this. And all I'm going to do is to apply the definitions. So there's going to be an overall factor of 1 over 8 pi. We're going to have the horizon integral. And inside the horizon integral, we're going to have a gradient of a linear combination of two killing vectors. And that linear combination, after I account for the minus sign here and the factor of 2 and the factor of omega h, it's going to be plus omega h phi beta. Right, so my black hole angular momentum quantity, there's a factor of 2 and there's a minus, there's a minus factor involved here, so that's why I needed this minus sign and this factor of 2. After that, I have an overall minus 1 over 8 pi factor in front of the integral, and the linear combination of the two killing vectors that shows up is precisely the one that is null on the horizon and is tangent to the null generators of the event horizon. So that's why I started out from here because I wanted to produce that inside the integral. And then we still have the ds coming inside the integral. All right. So let's be a bit more explicit. So this is the gradient of the k-vector that's tangent to the event horizon, tangent to the null generators. And we sort of lost track of this, but this is equal to minus 2, the antisymmetric combination of k and n multiplying the scalar surface element on the horizon. So I think I don't remember if I wrote it down before, but you know, that was part of this whole machinery of null hypersurfaces that we gave ourselves. We had an expression like this for the integration measure in terms of the two null normals to a cross section of the event horizon. The antisymmetrization operation here is redundant because by virtue of Killing's equation, this is already antisymmetric. So we can put all of those things together. I have this factor of 2, this minus sign, so that becomes 1 over 4 pi. And inside the integrand, we have the k component of the gradient. And this multiplies n beta, and this we integrate over the surface. Right, so I've just lowered the alpha, raised that one, put those two things together, the n beta remains, and the ds remains, and that's what we're dealing with. And now it goes very fast. We know that k alpha, the vector, satisfies the geodesic equation in generalized form. So this is kappa k alpha, sorry, k beta. We know that k beta multiplying n beta gives us a minus 1. I seem to have made a sign mistake somewhere. Oh, sorry, there was no minus 2. That was the... Yeah, sorry, there was no minus 2 over here. So there's still an overall minus sign in front. Sorry about that. Okay, so so k multiplying n gives us a minus 1. So now we kill that overall minus sign. So we get 1 over 4 pi integral over the horizon of kappa times ds. If kappa were not constant on the horizon, well, that would be the end of that road. But kappa is constant, so we can pull it out of the integral. And the integral will be the integral of ds that gives us the area. So by the zeroth law, we get that kappa can be pulled out of the integral because it doesn't depend on position on the horizon. And now we have the horizon integral of ds, so meaning that we're taking a cross-section of the event horizon and calculating its area. And of course, that is precisely what we called A before. So bottom line is that we have this very neat relationship between the mass of the black hole and its angular momentum and the area of its event horizon. And that's, you know, one of the things that I'm going to do to turn the mass formula that we had up there into the final expression that we have here. All that I have to do next, and I have time to do it in the next 10 minutes, is to work on the hypersurface integral. And after that, we'll have all the pieces. So is everything good with that calculation? All right. Okay, so let's work on the final piece. Okay, so now we have the first two terms on the right-hand side, so that's given to us by, so that's what we get when we replace the black hole mass up there by, you know, the rest of it. And then all that remains is that hypersurface integral that at this stage involves the divergence of the gradient of the Killing vector. So we have to work on this. And that's something you worked at before, first homework assignment. I think it was in the opposite ordering of the indices, but you know, because this is antisymmetric, it's basically the same thing with a minus sign. And I don't think I need to repeat this calculation. I'm sure you remember all about it. That's equal to the Ricci scalar multiplying the time like Killing vector. So that identity is just a direct consequence of Killing's equation after you take an extra derivative of Killing's equation and then commute second derivatives and involve the Riemann tensor. And eventually, because we're contracting indices, the Riemann tensor collapses down to the Ricci tensor. So all of this stuff you worked through before. So I don't think I need to reproduce this. If you don't remember, you can check the posted notes. You'll find the two-line calculation that gives me that. And then I'm going to use the Einstein-Fill equations to replace the Ricci tensor with the stress tensor of the matter. And now we get the full expression involving the stress tensor of the matter, but also the trace term that comes in the, you know, Einstein-Fill equations expressed in terms of the Ricci tensor. And that's what actually appears inside the integral over here. And putting everything together, well, we're back to the original statement that I wrote down before. So completing the steps, we have that the total mass at infinity is given by a first contribution from the black hole that we can express in terms of the area and the angular momentum of the black hole defined as I did over there. And then we have the final matter contribution that involves yeah, over there, I forgot to. Because I forgot to incorporate this factor over here. So it's actually minus 1 over 4 pi. Wait. I seem to have lost myself here. Oh, yeah. So it was, so it actually was supposed to be minus 1 over 4 pi, because I forgot this 8 pi, but now there's that factor of 8 pi that comes in. So we are back to factor of 2. And once again, we have the statement of the mass law. So sometimes it's called the generalized Smar law. And it's a decomposition of the total mass at infinity between a black hole contribution in terms of, you know, other quantities, and then the contribution from the matter. Yep?
It's supposed to be the plus of the energy, correct?
Here?
The other negative, right? Just the left. It should be plus 2 pi. Plus 2 omega h, j, h, yeah,
above. Sorry, where are you directing me?
On the angular momentum term, the j.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Sorry about all the sign confusion here. Because I was replacing mh by a plus. Yeah, it should be a plus. Thank you. Yeah. All right, so that's the mass law. And of course, that's not the same as the first law of black hole mechanics. The first law of black hole mechanics is going to be about a differential statement. But you know, you can well imagine that you can start from here and start taking derivatives. and then try to manage to deal with the surface integral and work your way through that and end up with something that looks like a first law. So we're going to talk about that in the afternoon. I think I'm done for the morning anyway. We're going to talk about this in the afternoon, but what I'm going to say now is that the task of differentiating all of this means that you have to differentiate the mass, that's good, but you also have to differentiate the surface gravity, you have to differentiate the area, you have to differentiate the angular velocity, you have to differentiate the angular momentum, and you also have to differentiate all of that stuff inside. So it's horrendous. And I'm not aware of any textbook that actually does this. And I think the only option that you have is to go back to the original paper by Barden, Carter, and Hawking, where they present the detail of the calculation, and it's pretty horrendous. So even Wald backs away from doing that calculation. So that says something, right? So I'm not going to do it. I was thinking I would actually subject you to this because, you know, why not? But I decided against it because it's horrendous. So I'm sort of going to fudge my way through the first law, and I'm going to, you know, sort of talk a little bit more about this, and first tell you what it means to do all of this derivative operation that I was describing. But then I'm going to consider a different variation that's going to be in a very different spirit, and that's usually referred to as the physical process version of the first law, which is pretty simple to derive, involves all sorts of nice geometrical quantities and operations, and I think gives us quite a lot of insight into the interpretation of the law, and then I'm going to be satisfied with this and hope that you will be as well. So we'll do that in the afternoon, and then we'll wrap everything up in the afternoon with a discussion of the second law, which will require very little calculation. It's basically going to be based on cartoons and understanding what it means. So we'll do that, and then we'll be done. So that's it for the morning. So don't forget your homework assignment, and I'll see you in the afternoon.